live. I was just testing to see if you could see me flex my biceps. So it looks like I'll be flexing my biceps for the entire podcast. My name is Jared. I head up financial services here at Travel Scale. Also in the possession of these guns. today we're here with two of our colleagues from Google, who I will allow to introduce themselves.
Hey, Frank Curry, customer engineering manager focused on financial services.
And Michael Craig, I'm a customer engineer working in financial services.
Yeah, so guys, thanks so much for joining us today. We have an agenda about 30 to 40 minutes. If you have questions, please don't hesitate. What we're going to be talking about today is the use of Kubernetes containerization in enterprise, predominantly how it's enabling kind of next generation of experience creation for financial services. But we're going to start at a high level, and then we're going to get down into some of the more kind of technical aspects and hopefully touch on, for some of you who are curious, kind of easy and quick ways to get started with these new technologies. So, I mean, these are words that are kind of, they get thrown around a lot. So we're going to start hopefully with a little bit of a, you know, 5 minutes on a, explain it to me like I'm five, for both kind of containerization and Kubernetes. So maybe we'll start with containerization.
Sure. So containerization is essentially the modularization of code. So one analogy to look at using the five-year-old example is like a child could get a truck or it could get Lego. When you buy a toy truck, it's all built. You know, changing things is a little bit difficult. But when you buy Lego, you obviously have to construct that. You get a lot more options on how you could potentially build that, but it's locked off into smaller chunks. And how you build gives you a lot more flexibility to implement. With containerization from a code perspective, I think people kind of jump into let's containerize things, and what that can mean, although that can mean different things to different people, in that some applications are can be easier to containerize than others, and you really have to kind of step back and look at what your application is. Do you start chopping that up, or do you start from scratch and try and build the same thing using a more modularized approach?
Got it. And so when we talk about Kubernetes, I know that's a hot topic for a lot of people. So what is Kubernetes, and what is the difference between it and GKE, which I think stands for Google Kubernetes for Enterprise?
Engine.
Google's Kubernetes Engine. Okay, sorry.
So Kubernetes is a container orchestration and runtime framework. So it handles the scheduling and provisioning of containers across a workload, typically a cluster of virtual machines. And it provides a declarative interface. So instead of thinking about having to do A, B, C, and D to get something done, you think about what the end state is that you want. And that's you declare how you want your application to run, you provide that information to Kubernetes, and it provides that end state for you. So you don't worry about the how so much as the what you're looking for at the as the end result. So it provides this kind of API interface that's common across all the different Kubernetes implementations. So whether you run that, you know, with Google and Google's Kubernetes engine, or on-prem, or with one of the other cloud providers, it's that kind of common interface because it's an open source project. GKE is Google's managed version of Kubernetes. And so the concept there is to take away some of the difficult parts of instantiating a Kubernetes environment. So Google handles what's called the masters, which are the systems that provision the nodes and do handle the scheduling, and all of that is done for you. And you really just worry about your actual workloads themselves.
So in environments that don't have a GKE or a product like it, you know, how are they currently managing? Is it a person who has to do all this, or the individual engineers and developers every time need to kind of set up their containers in certain ways?
I think, so there's two things at play here. You've got the development side, and then you've got the operations side. It gets shortened into the term DevOps. And Kubernetes, you look at it as kind of enabling for the operational side of it. Like, how do you allow for the developers to drop code in a fast and efficient manner? Mm-hmm. So it's essentially the brain that the developers leverage to kind of achieve scalability, or if they want to do certain types of testing where you know, from a customer's perspective, from an application standpoint, it looks the same, but your path through that application could be using different code sets. Doing that in Kubernetes or using containers, it makes it a lot easier. Doing that in a monolith or kind of the legacy state of applications, very difficult to do. You kind of have to spark up a similar instance and all of the ecosystem that comes with that. So I think like Kubernetes allows people to expedite application development. So coming back to your question, you know, how does that affect customers right now? I think, you know, Kubernetes is a really powerful piece of technology, but with that does come some complexities of how do you, you know, you still need to patch a Kubernetes cluster. And if you're doing that yourself, that can get quite difficult. So that some of those operational elements, what GKE or what Google's trying to do with GKE is get rid of those situations. So you take the operational side of it, you drop the complexity of that down, and you empower the development side, because that's ultimately what's going to be driving the business, is what the developers, the code changes that they can do, that's going to allow businesses to kind of move forward. If they're spending all their time dealing with the infrastructure, kind of defeats the purpose, and you're throwing money at something that potentially the business doesn't want to throw money at.
Yeah, there are articles published online. So as you mentioned, Kubernetes is an open source project. So an IT department could deploy that on bare metal or in a cloud on VMs themselves. Within Google, there's an article posting. I think if you do a Google search, Kubernetes the hard way, one of our DevOps relations folks, Kelsey Hightower, which speaks a lot on these types of things, kind of will give an instruction on how you'd actually run Kubernetes from the ground up. And I think it's like, it's a day and a half effort kind of thing if you know what you're doing to stand it up, versus I think it's on the Google console, it's like 90 seconds to spin it up in a managed way. I think most enterprises are looking at those types of managed ways to run Kubernetes, because the value really is higher up than the actual management of the infrastructure, whether that's on-prem or in one of the cloud providers.
Yeah, I think Mike mentioned a guy called Kelsey Hightower. If you get a chance to follow anyone, aside from the Trouble Scale folks, you know, after this, go and search for Kelsey, because one of the brilliant things about Kelsey is he's bringing the real world into the discussion. Like how, if you're an executive or if you're you know, someone looking at doing something different with regards to how you develop, Kelsey's tweets and, you know, his blogs and things like that are really powerful around, you know, not talking about the technology so much, but talking about the practical effects, the human effects of going to Kubernetes, which are things that people sometimes don't think about. Like, you know, with Kubernetes, this kind of implied, you know, development change to things like Agile. And that's a human problem that you're trying to solve. How you take someone who's developed using a different style or a different way of doing things into this new framework, you can't just jump into that. You have to kind of stop, think about, you know, what are the objectives, what are the projects we want to, you know, leverage containers for, and then look at the people effect on that as well.
So I think that's a really interesting point that we'll definitely come back to. Here at Tribal Scale, we are a partner of Google's. We work very closely with you on a number of things. And, you know, we're a partner because we believe in the technology. But for the majority of our clients, where they engage in the world that they live in is business problems, right? Where they're almost technology agnostic about the delivery mechanism or solution. More so, it's just, I have a problem, I need it to be solved. And I mean, being transparent, we find that technology-led engagements tend to have much lower rates of success because you're trying to shoehorn something that might not be the best fit into a solution. So, you know, we always try and take a step back and start with an open mind. So with that in mind, you know, understanding the capabilities, what are some of the, you know, I'll share some from our clients, but I'd love from your perspective, some of the things that you're hearing in market to which these types of technologies and approaches are driving, you know, either business outcomes, productivity improvements.
Yeah, I think like in this day and age and in financial services, so I spend a lot of, you know, time working with the large banks, but also technology startups who can kind of pivot and move very quickly. The larger organizations are looking for ways where, you know, they can move more efficiently and effectively. There's a quote out there by Rupert Murdoch where, you know, previously, it goes along the lines of previously the large will be able to deal with the small, whereas now I think the small, you know, is the differentiator, the people that are trying to kind of drive change. And with technologies like cloud, you know, they can do that. So you look at large financial services, they're trying to change, but they've also got, you know, 50, 60 years of IT infrastructure development, things like that at play that they're trying to work through as well. So I think there are some areas which kind of play better to, you know, going down the path of Kubernetes. So things where projects are starting, you know, from scratch. Alternatively, you may want to move to a containers-based solution if you're finding that your ability to deploy new features that are business-facing is being slowed down. Like if your turnaround time is 18 months for a new feature, you're not going to be able to keep up with the startups because they can just drop things in every 2 weeks using these sort of technology. And they can test dynamically as part of, you know, the framework that Kubernetes brings. So, you know, I think the larger organizations need to look at things. The small startups, they tend to be cloud native. They tend to use these technologies just from the get-go. So it's becoming the norm with regards to development environments going forward. I don't know whether you have anything.
Yeah, to echo that, yeah, to reinforce that, yeah, as you kind of mentioned, these things are driven by business outcomes and customer expectation and driving customer satisfaction in this kind of day and age. There's been an expectation set about the evolution of technology powering what we need to do in our lives. And so customers have an expectation that they're not going to wait 18 months for the next release of a product to have the feature that they're looking for. So to be able to deliver that, we have to map that back to technologies and frameworks and mindsets and processes to build these applications, and then a technology stack to put that on top of that will basically support all those, that end goal of delivering the best customer experience and constantly evolving and iterating on that to constantly improve customer sat.
I mean, you know, real world example from our experience here at Tribal Scale is we recently completed an engagement with a large North American insurance provider where they noticed that for some of their products, there was disintermediation between them and their customer endpoints. So they used to be sold through, you know, traditional channels like brokers and others. And now there was a proliferation of comparison sites, right? So if you think about, you know, that's the difference between buying from, you know, Expedia or Kayak versus buying directly from the airline. So they had to make a lot of their engines and decision-making engines and pricing engines now publicly available to websites that would be pinging them at irregular rates, but spiking traffic. Yep. And so what they found was that they were starting to be delisted from a lot of these aggregators as a result of uptime issues because they couldn't handle it. So, you know, this was a type of thing where the solution that we're talking about now is particularly interesting because it allowed them to meet the needs of these new smaller kind of startups in a way that drove kind of considerable business outcomes. Because if you're not showing up on search engines because your technology is too old, then customers have no way to find your product or buy it, yeah, right? And so I'd love to kind of get some thoughts on some examples like that.
So I think, insurance is actually a really interesting one. I find the insurance companies are, you talk to innovation teams in that space, and there's some really cool stuff happening, and they're bringing these new technologies in as part of those innovations. Like insurance is an area that is kind of ripe for, you know, moving forward. Mm-hmm. Whereas like banking it's a little bit different. They have to be a little bit more cognizant of the technologies that are in play there. That said, in some of the banks, again, there's really cool stuff. So they're picking up these technologies as well. They're trying to drive forward using them. And you look at that across Canada, and there's some really good examples out there of be them large financials, tier two financials, fintechs that are doing some really, really cool stuff. There's actually, you know, customers here, Tribal Scale customers that are doing some really interesting stuff, leveraging Kubernetes to do like mortgage analysis. Mm-hmm. So trying to solve that problem. But with that, you have to kind of iterate relatively quickly to kind of keep up with providing outputs to the people that need to make decisions. So if you've got an analyst coming to you saying, you know, I need this particular feature, you don't want to go back to them and say, yeah, we can do that. That'll be a year away. Mm-hmm. You want to kind of start iterating on something that could be prototypical, could be near production ready, you know, maybe in a month, if you've got the people resources to kind of enable for that. The technology now allows for that to move a lot quicker. The problem now comes back into people.
Yeah.
And I know we're going to chat about that and I keep coming back to it, but it is something like if you're listening to this as a leader, you're going to get bombarded with technology and shiny objects and things like that. But how your organization from a human resources standpoint is functioning, that's something you also need to really focus time on planning for, because there would be a need for significant change there.
I think, you know, one of the things that can't be understated is the prevalence of adoption of technology and tools like this across the variety of enterprises. I mean, as an example, you know, at tribal scale, given our exposure and our clients, the majority of Canadians interact with the product we build generally on an almost everyday basis, right? And we're building products like this. So if you look at the home screen on your phone, you know, the majority of tools that you're using, or if you're using enterprise applications that are at all contemporary, are built this way, right? So, you know, where this starts to become interesting is, you know, as we move from the edge case to the core, this is where the benefits of scale of some of the types of things that we're talking about really touch on. And I want to circle back to people in a second, but one question that I think, you know, comes up time and time again relates to security and governance. Mm-hmm. As one of the barriers of adoption to some of these technologies and financial services, you know, and it's not that they're, so I know it's more of an awareness thing. So I'd just love to give you guys an opportunity to kind of feedback to some of that.
Yeah, I think one of the advantages of Kubernetes is its openness and its ability to integrate with technologies and processes. Ultimately, typically when people adopt Kubernetes, they're looking to provide a platform, typically a platform for application developers to onboard and onboard in this new mindset of rapid iteration and development. But to do that, obviously, especially in financial services with the security requirements and regulation, there's a lot of systems that you need to tie into and a lot of rules. And some out-of-the-box solutions try to provide everything end-to-end and may lock in and not support that. Kubernetes is being an open source initiative, integrates with a myriad of other open source tools, mm-hmm. and it essentially gives customers the flexibility to build that platform for their internal or external users. But build it in a way that meets all of their security regulations and regulatory requirements, and also provides integration points. So we typically work with customers that have legacy integration points that are things that are not in scope to be moved or changed or upgraded. Mm-hmm. So we need to find a way to work with those, and that the open source nature of Kubernetes allows us to build what at the end is a platform that's an opinionated platform to the particular client's opinion of what they need.
So just to extend on that a little bit, one of the things that people conflate also is like Kubernetes to cloud and that movement off-premise into the cloud. And, you know, in financial services, a regulated industry, kind of to one of Michael's points, you know, if you want to get global scale, you kind of need to get to a cloud provider to execute on, like if you want to run AI, you know, at scale or machine learning at scale, you kind of need to go down that path. But to do that, you need data to move across with it. And there are technologies out there, and I think Kubernetes and a containerized solution can assist you in making that jump. Mm-hmm. There are technologies like Google's released or has released, and you'll hear more about, you know, some features in the coming weeks as part of our next conference, called the Cloud Services Platform, or CSP, which is essentially GKE in two forms. One is in the cloud, one is on-premise. And then you've got this security layer that spans across it, which is driven by a product called Istio. And Istio is looking at the different containers and making sure that, you know, who's talking to who? Do they have permission to talk to each other? And if you want to develop, you know, on this thing, you don't necessarily need to touch this other thing at the same time. The other benefit of that is if you do have data that can't go to the cloud for whatever reason, and there are examples of that, you can run GKE on-premise with your data on-premise and do processing over there or leave that part of the application on-premise and then run the horizontally scalable element out into the cloud. A good example of this is people trying to train machine learning models, Google has released this aggregation of technologies called Kubeflow, which is Kubernetes plus TensorFlow. So TensorFlow is a piece of technology that actually grew up here in Toronto. And bringing those two together allows you to train a model on-premise using your data, but then serve it out in the cloud using technologies like TensorFlow processing units. So you take that container, you can move things across between where you need compute and horizontal scale, or where you need this security element. So finding that kind of divide between the two is also really important for architects and business owners to understand as part of the move to a Kubernetes solution.
And so just to kind of touch on this, so Istio itself is an open source platform to which Google is a major contributor?
Yeah. So it came out of Google Lyft. There's a couple of other consortium members there. Google throws a lot of code at it. Google's a company that is very open source prevalent. If you go and look at large open source projects, of which Kubernetes is one, of which TensorFlow is one, of which Istio is one, Google's throwing code at that all the time, because our take on open source code is doing this across organizations will build a better product, because we can't think of all the use cases. We can't think of particular deployment scenarios that customers are going into. But if they pick it up and they kind of adjust the code, that's going to help someone down the path. So you get this velocity of product. And that's what you're seeing with Kubernetes, is people are kind of jumping on and leveraging that. Because it's not developed for a specific proprietary type of workload.
I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting is when we talk about open source and open source culture, at TribalScale, a big portion of our business is culture change at scale in large enterprise, right? So how do you convert the culture of engineering organizations and the teams that support and direct them to think, act, feel, in ways like startups that are customer-centric, around velocity and deploy and test, that are not their traditional ways of working. And a lot of what you're suggesting is prevalent at Google is something that we look to kind of embed in our clients. And one of the interesting challenges that we've had in developing that practice and getting to the point where we are one of the world leaders of it is it's the combination of people and tools, right? And so, just dropping people into workshops about being agile or lean or being customer focused drives limited adoption and success or impacts on your end products or business challenges, because they are then forced to use tools and adopt technologies that don't allow for that way of thinking, right? Yep. And so NFS particularly, there is a massive amount of monoliths. And maybe we've touched a little bit about what those are, that are inhibiting changes to some of, or the adoption of these types of cultures, because the pervasiveness is of, well, we can't touch it, we can't fix it, we can't deal with it, therefore we're never going to get the speed or skills we need to drive a customer-centric engineering culture. So maybe we'll take a step into this and kind of dive into what monoliths are.
My take on monoliths, I was actually part of an organization that actually had to pivot a code base from monolith into microservices. And it was a really interesting experience, like millions and millions of lines of code across very large engineering organization. A monolith is essentially like an application that is very tightly coupled. It could still be modularized in some way, shape, or form, but it kind of operates, for want of a better term, in this vertical manner, in that if you need to kind of adjust a feature or even do patching on it, you can affect the broader product just to change potentially a line of code. You could have to bring the whole thing down. Or in a customer's environment, you found a bug, you need to fix it. You need to drop everything, apply this patch, which is one line of code, and then bring everything up. If this is like a HADR kind of environment, that affects business. That's significant. Whereas with moving to a non-monolith, you can kind of just attach in the piece of code that needs to be replaced and then switch it in a very dynamic manner. So the application, most of the times, there are exceptions, can continue to function. So you don't have these downtime, as much of a downtime. So that's just one example.
So I mean, taking it up to a bit of an easier example, understand in an organization like a bank, a monolith service would be the system that maintains how much is in each account.
Yeah,
and how money moves from
core banking.
Core banking is an excellent example of monolith.
Yeah, for sure. It's and it's like you look where those systems came from. They came from the mainframe age. Mainframes, ironically, you could actually partition them back in the day. So the concepts of modularization is not new. IBM and the, you know, the other seven mainframe providers could actually do this 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. But they had to stay within that frame. And that's kind of one of the examples of monolith. There's everything inside of that is kind of safe and secure, and people don't want to touch it because it's working.
Yeah, I think the other thing to that point, obviously, there's the monoliths and the waterfall approach to development, and it's seen as a utopia, moving to microservices and everything is great and everything is free. But it's important to understand that there are trade-offs and considerations where you gain some things, you have to then take into account other factors that you may not have with monolith type design. Monoliths make internal function calls. Those are typically free and easy, and you always know it's going to return. When you move to function-based microservices, that call then starts to happen over a network, and that you need a way to control that, to observe it, and to understand the different patterns of communication, and also to work on standardizing interfaces between those so that you can make updates to microservices without breaking upstream or downstream systems to that. So the transition to microservices is not something that is necessarily right for all applications, but it's something that should be considered, but also take into account the trade-offs with that and the things that that you need to expect and plan for as you transition those applications.
I think part of that is you've got the business owner for an application. They're usually tiered with an architect. And I see that the architecture teams are beginning to kind of pivot their approach in that they're not just completely focused on technologies. There is these business elements like, okay, we want to break apart core banking and making it services architecture. What does that mean for the bank?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that really going to drive a change? Or do you look at starting building core banking 2.0 like from scratch and, you know, build it up from there? The other side from an architecture standpoint is you know, looking at the resources needed to do that. I think there's like agile is all about, you know, doing things dynamically and quickly and failing fast and moving on, like all those sort of terms. When you look at a banking system, you can't fail.
Yeah.
Like, you have to be really like banks go out of business if you don't do this correctly. You really have to think. So there's, you know, people moving those core monoliths across, a lot of thought needs to go into it. And I think the architecture teams that we're interacting with, their approach is kind of changing, I've seen over the last couple of years in how they interact. The business is trying to drive scale and getting that extra 7% and stuff like that. But then how do you make that move? You have to look at the technology. You also have to look at, do we have the resources to do this sort of stuff based on just flipping a monolith into microservices? It usually won't happen like that.
I think, you know, one of the challenges that we see with some of our clients is that when they're making that flip from a monolith to microservices architecture, there is an extended period of investment of time and resources that isn't generating visible business outcomes. So what they get is stakeholders and executives who are losing patience in the project saying, you know, you're spending a year, year and a half to get me to feature parity. I don't understand, right? But what we're hearing a lot of is that the long-term benefits are there. And so when we talk about interesting and exciting ways in which to get started with these technologies, you know, what are some thoughts around types of projects or areas to explore that will generate, you know, immediate business value or quick wins that can then help organizations gather momentum to start beginning larger scale reinvestigations of how they do businesses or build systems?
So here's my take on that, is you need to find a project that is core enough to the organization that it will touch most parts of the organization. And by that, what I mean is infrastructure folks, security folks, the business. If you pick off something that isn't kind of hitting security and then you make that successful and then you go and do something else and security does get involved, they're like, what is this?
Absolutely.
So you need to find something that is big enough, but then something that's small enough to be dynamic. Like you can actually kind of move it around. And maybe, you know, the other thing to look at is look at the business priorities. Are there things that could actually fit into those business priorities? Like, do you go after something that could deal with money laundering or fraud? These are things that are really important to financial services. Is there kind of a sub-project inside of that that will touch a broad sphere of the organization, but is not kind of too big that, you know, halfway through people are like, well, let's just pull back and go back to what we're doing because this is too hard? Like, how can you set yourself up for success?
I mean, interesting you mentioned that, because one area in which we've seen a massive movement amongst FIs in North America is consumerization of the employee experience. So bringing some of those best-in-class practices that you'll find in the creation of consumer-facing web and mobile experiences to the tools that your employees interface with every day. And, you know, why those are interesting places to start is, like you said, the touching on multi-stakeholder elements, as well as there tends to be more of a forgiveness when it comes to tools that employees are using versus things your customers are touching. Mm. But, you know, the return and value on improvements in productivity or automation opportunities amongst existing employees create these business cases that just look beautiful. I mean, you know, with times to pay back in less than a year, like all that kind of stuff that really drives executive excitement around new technology adoption.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree and echo your sentiments on that. The from the technology perspective, there's usually the characteristics that you look at in the applications and the systems that they touch, how they touch that, how that's going to happen within the organization, what the security requirements are there. Typically, you know, the low-hanging fruit obviously is usually like stateless web-based UI interfaces. Those are usually fairly simple applications to transition over and to scale in a microservices architecture, even if the back-end logic is going to be, you know, a monolith sitting somewhere else. If you can establish those communication patterns, Kubernetes lends itself other things that aren't necessarily web-serving too. We've looked at projects in risk calculation for this as well, where we have small compute bundles that work in that for the capital markets groups of financial institutions that perform risk calculations. And those run and scale extremely well in Kubernetes too. So it's more of a grid type environment for those as well. So those are all interesting use cases from a technology, but it's important to select something where there is, especially when you're starting down this path, you need something that has that ROI within the year to show tangible results.
Yep.
That's great. I mean, you know, we talk about risk calculations and especially, you know, in the capital markets context, because there's that kind of end of business, end of trading day need to run all these types of calculations, you know, containerization, the ability to virtualize kind of really drives serious business outcomes.
It can. I mean, you have to look at the whole workflow there. you know, there are situations where, like if a trader, if he's only getting actionable data, you know, the last 10 minutes of the day, and there's a mad panic to kind of execute on that, mainly because the processing leading up to that is so time consuming. If you can break that apart, do it in a more modular way, you could, instead of giving them the 10 minutes before close of trade, you've got like 10 instances during the day where we can update the data. And part of that is there's a Kubernetes element to it. There's a workflow element to it. There's also like the storage that you're using. Are you using storage technologies that the Kubernetes applications are interacting with that aren't built, you know, aren't kind of helping? They're kind of not scaling.
Yeah.
They're disparate. They're all over the place. So other things that kind of come into place that we see is things like aggregation of data into data lakes. So if you want to drive, you know, better insight for customer value, building an application that can scale horizontally, but then also giving it access to a large pool of data versus kind of a stove-piped approach, which is kind of prevalent now. Things like that allow for applications to derive insights in a more expedient manner for traders to execute better for their customers.
And so, you know, one thing at TribalScale we found is that the only way to really understand the experience of making change inside of an organization is to go and actively make change. So, you know, if anyone who's watching this or listening to this is at all curious about how Kubernetes or containerization can affect and drive real outcomes and business benefits to their business, you know, I think there's a conversation to be had with the three of us at any time that you're interested. Phones are open, you know, where we can chat about potential projects or ways to experience, you know, those types of benefits through kind of project work or upskilling and culture change amongst your engineers.
So just to extend that, like throw it back at you, I know you kind of covered that a little bit, but what, like, without using customers and things like that, but what is like a really good example of something that Tribal Scale has done with a customer? Like, I kind of use the analogy, Google is like Home Depot.
Yeah.
We've got a whole bunch of tools and you're walking through with your trolley and just throwing everything in. And at the end of it, you know, what you build is kind of, you know, if you're anything like me, it's a bit of a mess. Mm-hmm. You guys are the builders. You can kind of take the technologies and bring it together and also work with people. Like, what's something where you've had some success in financial services?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. The area in which we specialize and drive in differentiated outcomes in market is through our, like, enablement through delivery of projects. So where we work with clients is very rarely in a black box. You know, you don't give us a problem, we then pick tools and, you know, solve it and then return the end product to you. We leverage methodologies like pair programming that allow us to immersively build with our clients and in the process enable and upskill their teams in new technologies. So if you have something that you're considering modernizing or a new application build, how we would normally approach that is to build a agile team, a balanced team that is composed of both our clients' resources and our own. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes there'll be an equal number of Tribal Scale engineers to client engineers. And we have ways of organizing balanced teams that tends to drive massive cost efficiency amongst our clients, but that's another conversation. And then together we go and build and deploy on a new tech. So the idea being that as opposed to your individuals or employees spending time on a tool like Pluralsight and then needing to go to Stack Overflow every 5 minutes while trying to build something, you know, we're pairing them or embedding with them experts. And these aren't experts in computer science. Well, they are experts in computer science, but they're not experts in like lecturing or teaching. These are experts in developing, you know, and so they're building applications every day. And as a, what they're doing is enabling your clients in the actual kind of non-theoretical practice of using tools like Kubernetes or containerization, you know. And so examples that, you know, we see with clients, some recent metrics from an engagement is, you know, we start seeing things like 300% improvement in productivity. You know, we track that. All of our engagements are very metrics driven. We track that. And one of the tools that we find that drives that is because there's just less confusion because the availability of experts who've done this before. So it's not like you're reading tutorials or watching YouTube videos and how-tos to try and figure out your answers. You just go to your left and, you know, ask Sally or Jennifer, who's done this before, what is their optimal solution for doing this. Or, you know, you start seeing reductions in time to value, et cetera, by leveraging tools like containerization to deliver value quicker, right? How, what is the quickest way that we can deliver value to business that helps kind of justify the project, but also get things into states that are testable by both other teams like security, but also users. So, you know, a lot of exciting work kind of going on there. And what's really exciting about it is the ensuing culture change. Like once organizations realize they can do things quickly using technology, then the world of projects that they can take on as businesses opens wide, right? Yeah. I mean, one of the big challenges we find in enterprises is that they have to spend so much time picking a project because due to resource costs and time to development, they don't get to do many projects a year.
Right.
But if you can gradually reduce and considerably reduce the cost and time required to do a project, then you can try a lot more things. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying a lot more things, you're going to find more things at stake. So, sure. You know, so we're excited in, to be leaders in that kind of change inside of industries like financial institutions, but also transportation and media and entertainment. So it's a definitely interesting time.
There's more outside of banking, yeah.
Yeah, surprisingly. You know, you wouldn't think so being located in Toronto, but definitely, you know, it is helpful to know that. So, cool. You know, just want to thank you all for your time and all the people who gave us thumbs ups. You know, thumb up to you too for watching us and enjoying it. And, you know, where can people find us if they have questions?
So Mike and I are based here in Toronto, where the Canadian team is growing at quite a clip across Canada. If you want just general information, there's a whole bunch of information out there at cloud.google.com. If you need like a specific, you know, contact, please work through the Tribal Scale guys. We're super keen to kind of, you know, work with Tribal Scale, look at the problems you have, see where Google technologies can be advantageous. So I'd start with the Tribal Scale folks and they'll draw us in as needed.
Yeah, and you can find me at jared@tribalscale.com. And you know, we're happy to talk about any of your problems or opportunities.
Lovely.
Great, thanks guys.
Thanks so much.
For coming.
Thank you.
A lot of fun.